Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming into the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guest, and, well, for the first hour this evening, that guest is going to be Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster. Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I hope you are this evening.
Well, I'm doing fine. After reading your newsletter and seeing what's going on in the world, and certainly, you know, one of the things that really fascinates, you know, with so many of these bundled accounts of these mortgages, these mortgages which really are not performing, and a lot of the people holding those bundled mortgages are going to have problems. Why are the hedge funds going in there and buying those things up? Do they honestly believe that the market's going to turn around and they're going to be able to make a leveraged profit on that?
Well, they're buying them at a price that allows them a lot of leeway. The yields are around 10%. And so they figure probably they're only going to see a max of a 20% fallout. And what they do is they take those packages of mortgages, they're called securitized mortgages, and they're also called CDOs, and collateralized debt obligations. And that's actually what they buy, CDOs. And they figure it won't be that, you know, any worse than that. Well, already we're looking at 20%, and we're just getting into the subprime ALT-A problem. Anything that's FOIC rated 650 or lower is in the ALT-A or in the subprime category. These are people who have had a fair amount of problems paying bills, and they don't have good credit ratings. Above 650, it gets better. Above 700 is pretty good. And one of the things I'm seeing in the mortgage business is that we're seeing a lot of loans going down that shouldn't be. These are people with good credit, and what's happened is that their jobs are being shipped out of the country. So we have a large admixture to the problem of those who should have never got loans in the first place. And so it's kind of a jumble right now. It's going to continue that way as the recession moves on. Just before I called you, I was writing a piece pertaining to the housing market. And the new figures just came out today. And the index of pending sales, which is incidentally a very, very good yardstick of existing homes in the United States, fell to the lowest level in more than 4 years in April. And, of course, this is just symptomatic. The worst is yet to come. I mean, we're quite a ways away. And we're looking at a drop of 3.2%, and last month before, which was March, was 4.5%, and we're looking at a loss of about 250,000 construction jobs, which doesn't show up in government statistics because most of the people who have been let go are illegal aliens.
Well, now, do they think maybe the government's going to come in and bail these hedge funds out if they get into trouble, or...
They won't bail the hedge funds out.
I wouldn't think so.
There'll be attempts by states to assist those that can't make their payments, but what the states and the politicians
hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was asking Bob I mean, why in heaven's name would the hedge funds, you know, be going in and buying up these bundled home loans when so many of them were, of course, were given to people who never should have been able to buy a home in the first place with poor credit, a not adequate income to service their loans, you know, certainly these adjustable rate mortgages, and now, of course, there appearing to be defaults on these, and you would anticipate people would be running away from them. Instead of that, why, many of the heavily leveraged hedge funds are going in and buying these up with the idea that they're going to be able to make a profit on them. But if these hedge funds start to get into financial problems, it could shake the very foundation, you know, of our monetary system. You pick up the story from there.
The situation is such that the system is going to worsen because, as you said, many of the people shouldn't have had loans in the first place. The main problem in all of this is the Federal Reserve. Kept the interest rates too low too long and allowed the lenders to go berserk. And, of course, the lenders took advantage of it. 77 major subprime and ALTA loan makers, mortgage companies, small banks, are already out of business. 77. And we just started this thing, and that does not include the mom-and-pop operations of two or three people who pulled down the sign and just got out of business. And so this has got a long way to go. I figure about 2.5 more years. And I read this drivel out of the media saying that, well, we thought it was over this month, and I guess it isn't. Well, they knew it wasn't. And, you know, a lot of these people who might have been able to swing their loans, even though they really shouldn't have had them, maybe the situation's gotten better, but they don't qualify anymore. And so all these houses are going to hit the market for the next 2.5 years. And it's not only the lower end of the mortgage market, it's also the upper end, too, because of offshoring and outsourcing. And another thing has come into play big time in the last 2 years, and that is the private equity companies, which are doing leverage buyouts on, say, a manufacturing or a service company, and they go in and they load the company up with debt, they strip all the good assets out, and they resell the company, but...
All that thought, we'll be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Judge Bob is talking about how these leveraged buyouts are really going to really hurt a lot of industry. These scalpers come in, buy up a company, sell off all the good assets, load the company with debt, and then what happens, Bob?
Well, they lay half or more of the people off. And so you have people who have had good jobs for 20 or 30 years, professionals. You know, they're making 50 to 150,000 a year. We'll say about 100 grand a year on average. Bingo, they're out of a job. I mean, the whole world fell apart. They're over 40. No one will hire them. And they're dead meat. And, you know, once they finish their 6 months of collecting unemployment, they go down the rat hole. I mean, they're not counted anymore. That's why unemployment's around 13.5%, not 4.5%. In fact, it was the last two weekends in Barron's, Alan Abelson wrote about, finally, after 20 years, and I discussed this with him years ago, that the government was lying about all their figures. Finally, he came out and said what I've been saying. They're lying about everything. And so the situation is far worse than it looks. Not only employment, but also in inflation, which is 11% now. The money supply and the credit going into the markets, if you include not only the Fed in its creation of what they used to call M3, and if you add in the private creation of credit, you're looking at 15%. And in some countries like China, Russia, England, you're looking at China's 17.2, Russia's 48.2.
You're talking about this inflation rate? Is that the inflation rate?
No, this is the increase in money and credit.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Tantamount. The only thing you can deduct from that is productivity. And productivity in most of those countries, it'll vary from 2.5% to 4%. In the United States, it's 1.3%. And you want to know why? Because these people who have worked most of their lives are faced with getting laid off tomorrow morning because they're going to ship their factory to Shanghai, or their job is going to be outsourced to India, and they don't give a darn anymore. They're doing what they have to do, and that is why productivity in America isn't growing the way it should or has been in the past, and it's going to get worse.
Well, I see where certainly IBM is moving a large part of its jobs over to India.
They're moving everything out, Stan, everything.
And then, of course, Chrysler, the people who come in and bought Chrysler from Dalmar Chrysler, are simply apparently making plans to ship their major production overseas as well.
They're stripping the entire company.
Right.
They paid $7 billion for it. They're going to rip it to pieces, and everybody's going to be out of work.
Of course,
the whole thing is insanity.
And, of course, that way they'll be able to get away from their pension obligations, their health care obligations, and saying to the people here, sayonara, you know, it's not our responsibility anymore. And, of course, this is going to lead to terrible suffering on the part of the people who have been working for Chrysler for years.
What they're trying to do, Stan, and we've discussed this before, is rip the industrial and then the service economy in America to pieces, because it'll be easier for them to implement world government. And this is really what it's all about. And the LBOs, the private equity companies, are part of it. The illegal immigration is part of it. It's an onslaught that's all coming at once. And, of course, we have a new Congress. They are as bought out as the last one was. And if we don't throw everybody out of office and elect Ron Paul, the game's over.
Well, certainly things don't look very, very good for our economy, certainly. More and more of our jobs are simply leaving the country. And the average individual finds it difficult to believe that anybody would want to destroy the infrastructure of our nation, and yet that's exactly what's happening. And people shake their heads and say, I just don't understand. Well, if you understand that we're under attack, the attack is not over in Afghanistan or in Iraq, that is simply a diversion to take our attention away from what's happening here in America. As we are being invaded, the very foundation of our economic system. Our currency is being destroyed, our industry is being destroyed, our job base is being destroyed, and it's all part of a long-range plan to lower the living standards of our people.
You know, I wrote an article on this for the American Mercury in 1967, and as I look back, I am astounded. I could have been as so prophetic as this, but I try to figure out a way that they could induce, force the American people into accepting world government. And that was the method, to destroy the infrastructure of the country so people wouldn't have jobs, they'd have depression, and they begged government for help, and the government said, well, yeah, if you join the New World Order and run around in brown shirts like George Bush wants you to do. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's happening as far as the stock market is concerned. The stock market looks great. It keeps going up here, but the question is, why is it going up? Certainly, some of the companies are making fairly good profits, but they're not making them here in the United States. They're making them overseas. And they're making them their overseas operations, most of them.
Well, you know, the stock market's supposed to go up because the U.S. economy is doing better overall or in general. And that isn't true. For about three and a half years, the earnings of American corporations increased approximately 18% a year. And this year, this is last October, November, I projected 4 to 8% growth, down from 18%, and all the experts averaged 13.5% growth, and the figures just came in; they were 6.5%.
Well,
I was dead on.
Don't you think this massive liquidity that's being created all over the world? In other words, every country is creating money out of nothing. You would have a tremendous prosperity if you have a monopoly game, and they just keep printing monopoly money indefinitely, but the day comes when, of course, they got to turn off the presses. But right now, they're just pouring money. Don't you think that that's, at least in part, responsible for the fact that the stock market keeps going up?
It's the only reason why it goes up. I mean, it's just as simple as that. It's the only reason. Because the fundamentals are certainly not there.
Well, apparently, you know, the Chinese stock market is just completely out of control. I mean, everybody over in China is playing the stock market. Everybody over in China is getting sick. The doorman, the maid, they're all making money hand over fist. And even the Chinese government is concerned about the stock market. Economy over there just completely out of control, just like it was here in 1929. Do you share their concern?
That's what I said in the international forecast on Saturday. The fingerprints, the blueprint is right there, and the same madness. And they're creating, last week they created an average of 310,000 new stock brokerage accounts a day. And in the last four business days, the speculative part of the market's been down 10% per day. In the better quality issues, it's down approximately 12% over that period. But it's going to keep on going down. And what the Chinese don't understand, what they've done is that they've tried to cool off the market. And they've done a number of things to do that. But suppressing it is one thing. Controlling the suppression is totally another. And they really don't have any experience of this. I know they've gone to universities. They've studied all this sort of thing. And that's nice. That those who live in the ivory tower, they're different. They've never had to get into the street, like into the economy, and fight it out. And they're having a hard time, and they will not be able to control it. And if this Chinese market breaks further, it'll take every market in the world with it.
Including our stock market?
Sure.
Now, what then will happen to commodities, certainly copper and the other things that have been going up so well?
Well, commodities should hold their own and maybe even rally as a place where you can put your money that's in a physical asset. But that will only last for so long until the hyperinflation ends. And hyperinflation ending is 2 to 2.5, maybe 3 years away. And that's a guess. I mean, you know, I'm good, but I don't have a crystal ball. And that's the way I see it. And, you know, the minute you stop using the credit, and that's the real problem is the credit, you being large corporations and hedge funds, the minute they diminuate risk and they cut back, that creates the problem because if the money's not being used and the credit's not being used, it doesn't matter how much you create. And once deflation catches on, there is absolutely no controlling it. And nobody knows better than that than Ben Bernanke, who runs the Fed, whose thesis was on the crash of 29 and the aftermath.
And that was what he said, of course, we will never have deflation because we can always throw just print money and throw it out of helicopters.
But well, what's going to happen? You're going to have 1923 Weimar over again.
Right. Well, if he does that, of course, he'll destroy the value of the currency, destroy the value of everybody's savings, everybody's pension fund, everybody's CDs, and you'll still have, you know, $1 million in the bank, but it may not buy a loaf of bread. People can't imagine that happening here, Bob, but could it happen here?
Absolutely.
We're going to be back.
In fact, it is going to happen here.
We'll be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman here at Radio Liberty. Okay, well, Bob, certainly they've certainly been very interesting to see the gold and silver been rallying just a little bit here and this last week.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Tieri. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Since 2000, when he went through his crucifixion, and most of them lost 50 to 80% of their money in the market. 55% of the trades now on the New York are done by hedge funds. Then there's the other institutions, and then you have black box players. These are people who just play momentum. And they use algorithms and other programs to generate their buying and selling. they make up 92% of the market. Only 8% are retail investors.
So many of these are very, very large investors and overall who are in the market.
Yeah, when they try to get out, who are they going to sell to?
Now, what about the shorts? You mentioned in one of your recent letters that the short interest, in other words, people who are selling stock that isn't theirs, planning on the stock price falling, are increasing in number. Is that still holding?
Yeah, it is. And unfortunately for them, is that this record short only brings in more buying by the hedge funds, because they know that the short's got to buy back in somewhere along the way. And so that big short position is propelling the market higher than it would have gone otherwise. And then, of course, there'll be a big burst when the shorts come into cover and they throw in the towel. And then after that, you know, you can hear the noise as you go into the bottomless pit, because that's what happens in markets. And the shorts are aiding the upside in a non-fundamental market, a market that's being driven purely by credit, the margin outstandings at a record as well.
And by credit, you mean that borrowed money? What are they doing, borrowing it over there in Japan at 0.5% interest, something like that, investing it here?
Yeah, 0.75% interest. They'll borrow, say, $1 billion, and then they'll convert the $1 billion, and they'll buy U.S. treasuries, and then they'll take the treasuries and they'll use them as collateral, using about 8-to-1 on the treasuries. And then they'll take that money, and then they'll parlay it again, probably take their leverage up to 50%. And so they'll start off with $1 billion. They'll have $50 billion. And they just play the game like it was some grand casino.
Are they making money? Are they holding their own at the
present? Most all of them are at this point. There's a few that haven't. But, you know, again, who do you sell to on the way down? Now, that's why they created this turquoise market, they being J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, etc. What they're going to do is they are going to secretly get rid of their big stock positions by going to institutions directly and offering them stock. And that'll keep the trades off of the exchange, and people won't know that Morgan and Goldman and others like them are bailing out of the market. And they're going to leave pension funds, government retirement, holding the bag.
Well, have they started doing that at the present time?
Yeah, they started about 2-3 weeks ago.
In other words,
it's incredible what's going on. There's no regulation. You know, these big firms do anything they want. I spent 28 years on Wall Street. I know exactly what they're doing.
In other words, basically right now, they're beginning to dump their stocks in preparation for the market dropping, and most people are totally unaware of it.
Well, they've created the vehicle. Whether they're sellers or not, I don't know. But when you create the vehicle, it's because you are going to be a seller sometime along the line.
No idea when that's going to happen, though.
Well, you know, when you see that the borrowers, the great large borrowers of money, start cutting back, and then you'll know the game's going to end.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman as we discuss what's really going on behind the scenes there in the markets, and hopefully people can begin to position themselves. I think that we are moving into an increasingly dangerous position here in the United States and throughout the world. And I mean, you can't just keep printing money indefinitely, creating new credit indefinitely. I mean, it's a great game while it lasts, but eventually, of course, you're going to see that great financial tsunami, that great wave that's going to sweep across America and the whole world and inundate our economic and financial structure. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Bob Chapman, and we're talking about the what's happening economically. Bob is talking about a turquoise market. Why are they calling it a turquoise market?
I don't know. Just something they dreamt up.
Is this a new phrase? I've never heard it before.
No. That happened a few weeks ago.
Well, I know, but I mean, have they ever talked about the turquoise market before that?
Never.
All right, so it is a relatively new phrase. And
it's an invention.
New invention. And so you say that we'll be able to tell as soon as we see them beginning to dry up the ready credit. Would this be it? But how are they going to dry up the credit? How are they going to keep it from just printing more money and, of course, creating more credit?
Well, the Fed and the other central banks do what they want. They have a license to steal.
Well, I know, but do you think the Fed is going to do this at this time? Because they know very well, if they begin cutting back on money and credit, why, the game is over, and they'll be held responsible for the catastrophic results.
Well, they don't care about that. They have a different agenda. And that agenda is the one world agenda. And that is to destroy the American economy, implement world government, and a one world dollar or currency or whichever. And that's what they're gunning for, and they don't care about the mayhem and process. I mean, these people, just as an example, if you think financial chaos is bad, these people financed every war for the last 1,000 years on both sides. And you know that. Maybe our audience doesn't, but they do now. These are the same group of people, and they keep on doing it over and over and over again. It's just that today we have a lot of communication that we didn't have just 10 years ago, and never mind 300 or 400 or 500 years ago. And so the game gets scrutinized much differently than it has been in the past. And so consequently, they are going to have problems, because they are going to go for it, even though everything's not in place. And the reason why is they can't reverse what they've done economically. They've got to have the depression whether they like it or not. And printing money and issuing credit is not going to be able to save them from doing that.
In other words, what you're anticipating is a new global currency, and we'll talk about a little bit more about that when we get back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've been talking to Bob about what he thinks is going to happen. He thinks that they are going to destroy our currency, destroy our economic system, and impoverish our people, and it all has to do with the creation of a global government. Now, before we go on, Bob, I want you to get your website out there and tell people how they can get copies of the International Forecaster.
Well, the Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. We publish via email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, runs around 30 pages each time, and we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month. And if you'd like to visit our site on the Internet, that address is theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. And if you'd like to call toll-free to get a free copy, which you can get off the site as well, you can call toll-free 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And we'll get you a copy of either.
All right, fine. Well, of course, we were talking about really where we are headed, because Bob is talking about a new global currency. Now, then what would happen to our old currency? How would we be able to redeem this for its full value if we had to do
global currency? Well, we don't know what full value will be when they do it. And, you know, I heard all kinds of estimates of when it's going to happen. And, you know, this evening I had a conversation. They were talking you know, it happening in 20 months, and you know, nobody can put a timetable on it. It's impossible.
Well, no,
because they're going to run into problems.
A lot of people are talking about we'll have the Amero, the counterpart of the Euro, and maybe a South American Amero, or you know, would they? You think they might short circuit that and move directly into a global currency? Or is there any way really to tell?
Well, look, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we're over three years away, minimum, and it's not going to be as easy as people think. This thing isn't a gift wrapped by any means. And I've seen actions by the insiders, like Ben Steele's dissertation for the Council on Foreign Relations. He's on loan from the Royal Institute in London. He's been on loan for about 13 years, and finally he's come out, and he's doing what he was sent there to do. And that is talk about three currencies: an Asian currency for all of Asia, the American dollar for North and South America, Mexico and Central America as well, and then the euro, which is already in existence. And I think that that's the way they would like to go, and then meld the three together. I don't think that you're going to see an Amero, and I just don't. And they're going to have a heck of a time trying to form a North American Union. I mean, the congressmen's phones are just ringing off the hook, and the emails are just inundating them about all sorts of things that we talk about in this program, such as the North American Union, the Amero, the North American Highway, where they're going to bring these goods from other places up through Mexico, and then immigration and illegal immigration, and on and on. Congress is finding out that the people are livid and they're serious, and both parties are very willing to oppose 82% of the constituents who want the illegal aliens out of the country. And he's still going to try to make a deal. And I saw Conyon on Lou Dobbs' program tonight. He said, well, we have to have a deal, so this is the best we can get. Well, I get news for you. That's ridiculous. We don't need anything. All we need to do is pick them all up and send them home. I mean, I don't think that's very difficult.
Well, did you read that article in Foreign Affairs magazine where they were talking about a global currency and possibly a gold-backed privately issued currency? I thought that was a very, very intriguing concept.
Well, that's a possibility. And the reason why is that I think, especially back when gold was between $250 and $500 an ounce, I think all of the large sales were purchased by Illuminous. And in fact, I still think a lot of it is being purchased because they know gold is going to go considerably higher from here. And it's going to be a way to wealth, a place to keep your assets as opposed to all of it being in dollar or euro or whatever denominated assets. You know, people talk about, you know, avoiding getting caught and avoiding the problem of losing money. And, you know, currencies are not the answer because they're all bad. None of them are back. So even if you're the whiz of the market and you're in there and you're making 30 or 40 or 50% on currency trading, you're still then going to end up with dollars. So, for all intents and purposes, the only thing that you can do is go to the ultimate money, and that ultimate money is gold. And that's whether we have hyperinflation or deflation. It doesn't make any difference. Gold is the only money, and that's where you want to be.
But could the price of gold go down if we had deflation?
Yes, but only about 20%.
Where everything else, of course, you're saying would drop a great deal more than that.
Yeah, 60 to 90% was the experience during the Depression, and things are much worse now, credit-wise, than they were during the Depression.
Well, certainly they've been artificially holding down the price of gold here for a few weeks, and now we see it moving up about $20 an ounce over the last week to 10 days. Do you anticipate that it's really going to break out on the upside, at least for the time being?
Well, we spent a year, gold and gold shares, particularly the big gold shares, they have been trading in the same area, more or less, for a year. And what that does is it creates a foundation. It creates a tremendous support level. And once you see large money coming in, and you're seeing large money, large, big, permanent, full-time investors coming into gold, and you'll start to see it to the shares as well, all of a sudden you wake up one day and gold will be up $40. And the following day it'll be up $20. And the next day it'll be up 100. I've seen this before, and it will happen again. And it is going to happen. And there's no way it can be stopped.
What will happen to the gold stocks when that occurs, you think? Or you want
They'll go crazy. You know, they'll go 10 to 20 times. And the exploration stocks will make even bigger money because they're leveraged. I mean, it wouldn't be unusual like the last time around in 80. We saw stocks go from a dollar to 40 bucks. And I had two stocks that I started buying in 73 at 35 cents each, East Rand Proprietary and Durban Deep. And I sold them at $54 and $52 respectively.
Well,
so there's a lot of leverage in the shares that you don't get in the bullion and in the coins and so on. Not that the others aren't good. They are. It's just that for those who can afford to take more risk, they, you know, they use stocks and coins as well. But basically stocks. And the final analysis, that's where you gotta be.
In other words, you want to be in gold stocks, but you want to get out of them before it hits the top. Is that right?
That's why they subscribe to the International Forecaster, my son.
I know. All right, fine. Well, we'll pin you down right today, but maybe next time we have you on, we'll talk a little bit more about specific gold stocks. Right now, then, do you think that gold and silver, silver's certainly been doing fairly well for this last week. It's up almost, at least 75, 80 cents over this last week to 10 days.
Well, again, it's been the leader of the pack. And, of course, it's manipulated, and our government stands by and allows it to happen. And they're in on it. And one of these days, when gold and silver both break out, they'll be looking at $25 silver and $8.50 gold, and they'll wonder what happened. And then gold has to get up to $2,200 an ounce just to reflect inflation since 1980. And that, I think that is an absolute lead pipe cinch. And if it is, you're looking at $100 silver.
Okay. Well, anyway, of course, it's going to be interesting to see as this story unfolds. And I just have this feeling, because I've been looking over your shoulder for a long time and watching it on my own, going back for 45 years, I think we're on the edge of some very significant things. You know, maybe it's a little indigestion, but my gut tells me that we are going to see some exciting things here in the next several months. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think you're right. I think they're going to be driven by events. As you saw just recently,
Kuwait
went off the dollar peg today. Syria went off. United Arab Emirates are next, and all of the Middle East is going to go off. 6 years ago, we were looking at 72% of foreign exchange reserves of central banks were in U.S. dollars. The beginning of this year, it was 67%. Last year it was 67. At the end of last year, it was 60. No, at the end of the first quarter, it was 64.7%. They're getting out as fast as they can.
Well, do you think they're going to come over here and just start buying up the whole infrastructure of our society and our industry?
If they had any brains, that's what they've been doing. But, you know, people don't like the United States to do business in. They'd rather, invest the money in their own countries. And that's why, you see, the reason that they are getting off their dollars is that when you import dollars, what happens is that you create inflation. And inflation is running 8 to 12% in the Middle East. And that's because they've got all these dollars. And so Mexico hasn't got hit yet, but they will. They're big, big dollar users. That's the reason that they're switching.
Well, I was reading something written by a Soviet general who said that, there are more dollars out there in reserve currencies being held throughout the world than the value of all the land and all the stocks in the United States. Is he exaggerating?
No. Russian reserves are over $400 billion.
Right.
It was just 9 years ago they were bankrupt.
Right. And, of course, the reason that they're doing so well is we've been pouring money into that country like it's going out of business. Exxon has a $20 billion development. Certainly Royal Dutch Shell has a $20 billion development. British Petroleum has a $20 billion development. And even with the massive reserves that Russia has, the United States Export-Import Bank, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, Treasury, Department of Defense, Department of Education, AIDS a Fund, and all others are still pouring money into Russia, and we have to go out and borrow $2 to $3 billion every day to meet our bills? Is this madness?
It's as bad as it gets. It's $2.4 billion a day.
Really, $2.4 billion today they're having to borrow, and yet we're giving it to Russia, who has reserves up to $400 billion. And, they were bankrupt 8 years ago, and we've made them want to have... what do we have in reserves? How much would we actually have in reserves if we were asked?
It's $230 billion, including the gold that they were supposed to have, and I don't think they have any gold.
You're talking about us.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we, in fact, Russia then has almost more reserves than we do.
Almost double. They're number three in the world.
And
Taiwan's number four.
And we're pouring money into Russia, and at the same time they've got more money than we do, and yet we're just giving them the money. Here, this incredible thing, we're going to guarantee a loan for China so they can, $5 billion so they can begin putting in nuclear power plants built by Westinghouse, which is a Japanese company. I mean, the world's gone mad, and only a few of us are sane, and everybody thinks we're crazy.
That's right.
What would you tell people to do right now, listening to this program?
Get out of debt. Get rid of your credit card debt. Revolving debt. And it may not be too late to get out of your house if you wanted to... make a change, because I think they got a ways to go yet. I think the average house is down somewhere between 10% and 18% in most of the former hot areas. So we've got another, let's say the number is 15, we've got another 25% to go easy. And so there's going to be room on the downside for your house to fall. And so if you wanted to get out, it'd be a good time to do it. But there's so many houses available. It's hard to sell. And the other things, gold and silver related assets, I think are very important. And I think that's really the basics. It's what I've been telling people for a long time. And it's worked very well. The subscribers are making piles of money. And because they're patient. and they're waiting this thing out. Some of the stocks work quickly, and some of them don't.
And so Payday, just sit tight, and the major thing, of course, is do not try to get rich, because ordinarily the people get rich in a market like this, unless you're very sophisticated. An awful lot of people are going to lose everything, aren't they?
They sure are.
And so what you're suggesting is they just take a very defensive, conservative position. And one more time, the number where people can get a copy of the International Forecaster?
That's 800-375-4188, 800-375-4188.
Well, I tell you, it's a fascinating thing. I enjoy reading it. It comes twice a week, and you know, I look forward to getting every time, and we'll be back in just a minute to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Bob, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, I thank you very much. I think one of the things people should consider here is that gold and silver related assets, the shares as well as the coins and the bullion, more or less are really where they were a year ago. And so we haven't had any big move, but we've had a great consolidation. And if you're going to add for the positions you have, you want to do it now. And if you want to buy more coins and bullion, you want to do it now. Don't wait, because I think this could be the last cheap price. And I've been pretty good at calling these markets, and after 48 years here, you get a feel for it. And believe me, it's not scientific, I'll tell you that. There's no market you can put a slide rule to. People seem to think that they can, but they're fooling themselves. And particularly when you have markets that are in a manipulative procedure by governments. I mean, you can just throw all those charts and graphs and waves and cycles out the window. And once they stop that manipulative process, which will come in the next year or so, then you can use those things again. But right now you can't. And so you go in there and... if you're looking for stocks, we recommend them. If you're looking for coins, there's all kinds of coin dealers, we can recommend one. And we have no financial ties with anybody. And we give people advice for nothing. And that's because we want to help people and we want subscribers. That's all we're interested in.
And you have an awful lot of subscribers all throughout the world, don't you?
I sure do. They're all over the place and everywhere from Kazakhstan to Australia to Hong Kong, and don't have any in China yet. And we've got Fidel Castro and Chavez who read it every week. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but anyway, they do.
Do they really?
Yeah. They're subscribers.
Well,
Grandma actually is a subscriber in Cuba.
I see, okay.
And it's run by a Canadian, actually. And they subscribed through there, and I said, well, why? And they said, well, because Fidel was given a copy by Chavez, and he wants to see it every week.
All right, fine. Well, I guess I think it's important that we're as smart as Chavez and Castro. Anyway, our guest has been Bob Chapman. It's always a pleasure. We'll look forward to having a Bob on again later this month. And so until then, Bob, God bless. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'll be back.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to, first of all, remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we depend upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out, you know, 5 hours every day on radio, shortwave, internet, you know, 4 hours a day on the shortwave. You can hear us 9 hours a day on satellite, but we're really live 5 hours a day on different networks. And when you join the Radio Liberty family, you become part of our team, part of our helpers. Well, certainly if you want to think about what we've been talking about this evening, remember, I'm not a financial forecaster. I'm simply an observer. But Let me point out that we put together a talk. It's called Financial Tsunami. It comes with a syllabus, and certainly it's got a lot of great information in it. Just to give you a glimpse of what's going on today. Financial Tsunami, it comes in video or VHS, and of course I suggest you get the syllabus along with it, because it gets the text of what we say, and then of course it's got a lot of the documentation on what we talk about as well. And then of course we carry the books, Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, a little pamphlet I've written called The History of Money. Now, you really need to know about the history of money, because, you know, where did it come from? What happened in ancient Greece? What happened in ancient Rome? What happened in Florence and Venice? And there's nothing new under the sun. It's happened so many times before, and you're seeing it happen again today. And then, of course, one advantage we have is we look at the spiritual forces behind the monetary system, which I don't think most people do. And if you have not yet, of course, read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the DVD. But then our latest talk on, and it's entitled Forbidden Secret, and it's available in VHS, it's available in DVD, and there's a syllabus that goes with that, Forbidden Secret. And then, of course, I have a new four-tape set. It's called The Secret Behind the Secret, and basically it addresses the phenomenon that's sweeping across America, Rhonda Byrne's little book, The Secret, and the DVD, The Secret. What is the secret? What happens when you apply it? Can you really, of course, get great wealth and success by applying these techniques? And I want to tell you, in many instances, they work, but at the cost of your eternal soul. Do not, under any circumstances, delve into this, but understand what's going on. Learn. That's The Secret Behind the Secret, a four-tape set. It's the only thing we have right now that's going to explain what's going on. We hope to have a DVD soon. And certainly Pastor Joe Schimmel, will put something out, and we'll have it by summer. But in the meantime, we need to protect the people. And that's why we put together this four-tape set, 2 hours with Joe Schimmel, 2 hours with other people. The Secret Behind the Secret, this four-tape set, nothing like it. And we'll explain to you what this is really all about. And then, of course, if you have not yet seen the DVDs, the Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, the second in the series, Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of America, the DVDs, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, put out by Chris Pinto, a DVD which we carry, I guess we have in VHS, and it'll be in DVD very shortly. The Atlantis Connection, actually it's a talk that Chris Pinto gave here at our syllabus. You'll want to see that. You'll certainly want to see Wisconsin's Company's talk on The Emergence. It's available both DVD and video, and it's her experience researching the New Age. We carry a book on the hidden dangers of the rainbow. We even have a four-tape set of my interviews with Constance. All of this information, if you'd like to know more about it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And well, right now we have with us in studio a gentleman who for many years, it must have been 10 years ago, used to come up in the evenings and answer telephones for us. And he had a job here, and just a regular job in Santa Cruz. And he felt the calling of the Lord to go off and become a missionary. He's gone over and has been... Ed Dipper, how long have you been over there in Kazakhstan?
In Kurdistan.
Kurdistan, right.
Kurdistan, Iraq. About 6 years.
About 6 years. So it's been about 6 or 7 years he's been gone. And, of course, we've been certainly looking over his shoulder. And we always look forward to his coming home. But working there in Kurdistan, certainly among the Kurds, primarily a Muslim culture, but trying to bring, of course, the message of Christianity to them, establishing Christian school. And it's amazing how many of the Kurds, the Muslim Kurds, will put their children into a Christian school. So we're just going to start out getting a little information, and then we'll open up the lines if you have a question from Ed, because he's just back from Kurdistan, and certainly... Now, certainly Kurdistan has not been really affected by what's going on in the rest of Iraq, has it?
Well, economically, it has been very much affected. As far as what you see in Baghdad or in Basra or in Mosul, and some instances in Kirkuk, which is east of my city, obviously not. But it has been affected economically, and we can talk about that as well as what's going on with the church. What's going on with some of the politics, with some of the religion, and what's going on with the schools in northern Iraq.
Well, why don't you just start at the very beginning, cover the things that you think are important, and then we'll open up for calls.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to hear the calls tonight. Well, let's start with this. You know, the church that exists over there is a variety of churches. You have the ancient Chaldeans and the Assyrians, which have been there for quite a long time. And then you have the Kurds, which are like gypsies, so to speak, of the area. Now, Kurdistan is a political region. It's a political map. It doesn't really exist, quote. But Kurdistan is a part of Turkey, Iran, obviously Iraq, Armenia, and Syria.
But this is a specific people. It's the only people in the world who really don't have a country, isn't it?
Yes, to my knowledge, 35 million Kurds, which outnumber the Palestinians, obviously, by a great number. And they are ancient, the Medes, you can find them in the Bible, in Acts chapter 2, and also in the book of Daniel. They were part of the Persian Empire.
Yeah, no, these are the Medes. We speak of the Medes and the Persians, and these were the Medes, okay.
Yes, they their ancestors and their forefathers were the Medes. So the Kurds are the descendants, they're Indo-European people. They are not Arabs, just to make that clear.
All right, fine. Are they more like the Persians or like Aryans?
Right, that's true. They're obviously an ancient people, but they're an ancient people that have gone through many, many wars, many, many setbacks. There was a time where they were actually leaders of their country, and they did quite well, but because of a greater strength and greater political power, and also infighting. Kurds are known for infighting and shooting themselves in the foot. So this also set them back as well. But what's going on in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, which is about 4 million Kurds in the north, is a phenomenal thing indeed. Because of the fighting and the infighting with the Shia and the Sunni and other political and tribal situations and parties in the south, a lot of people are starting to leave the south now, Baghdad, which is, you know, Baghdad's 5 million people, Dr. Stam, and moving to the north or going to Jordan or going to the States or Europe.
Well, because Jordan and Syria don't want any more of the refugees from Iraq, do they?
Probably not. And I can't speak on that definitively, but probably not. But they're going to take some anyways. But this is not, to my knowledge, this is not refugees, you know, poor people, but this is affluent people. In fact, I met some at the church that we fellowship at, you fellowship at, there's some Assyrians that go.
Right.
And their relatives are leaving and going to Jordan and then coming over to the States. So it's not dirt poor people who are dirt poor people can't get out of Iraq.
All right, fine. So the people are moving up there. Do they bring their money with them? How have they been able to survive? As in the value of the currency, you know, is not held up. Are they people who've had foreign bank accounts, gold, silver? How have they been able to maintain their wealth in this war-torn existence that you find in southern Iraq?
Mm. Yeah. I don't know too much about the gold and silver. I've never seen that. But Iraq is not a poor country. It's not a third world country like Darfur or Somalia, what have you. There are poor people in Iraq, don't get me wrong. But there are many wealthy people in Iraq. My friend, who's Kurdish, who lived in London for 11 years and came to the Lord in London, came back and bought a house, cash, for $67,000. And that was a small house. Okay? And then he refurbished it and remodeled it, put another $10,000 in it, cash. All right? So this is very common. How do you think people pay when their relatives are kidnapped? They pay cash. I know this for a fact because a friend of mine's cousin was kidnapped and they wanted somewhere around $85,000, and they bargained it down to about $30,000, and it was paid in cash. So the money's there.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, Kurdistan today is really prospering, isn't it? I mean, I see pictures of the new department stores going in, the new grocery stores. I mean, they look like those big Safeways, the other things we have here. Kurdistan's really taking on a very modern appearance. I mean, here we are, just a country just 5-6 years from, from the occupation by us, and really, Kurdistan's really prospering.
Yes, that's true. There are more cranes in the city of Erbil building than there are mosques. There are. When I was in my city, towards the border of Iran, there were no grocery stores. The only one that you can find was in Duhok, which is up by Turkey, and that was called Mazi Mart. You can look at that on the internet as well. Or you can go to World Magazine. I think it's 2000... I think it'd be 2003. Let me see.
Okay, fine. Well, now, what about the church? What about the Christian church there? Because this is primarily a Muslim nation.
Well, yes, as I was saying before, that there are the Assyrians and the Chaldeans, which are an ancient Christian church. I want to talk a little bit about some of those, them in just a minute, about some of their problems. And then there are the Kurds. The Kurds are relatively a young Christian group. The Presbyterians and the Baptists did a lot of evangelism and a lot of church planting in the 1880s and 1890s, and spent their life, Cumberland was one of them, that spent their life giving to the Muslim people and sharing with them the Christian faith. This is what's going to really change Kurdistan, I think, in Iraq. I've always said that democracy without the gospel isn't really going to flourish. You can bring democracy to any country, but really, without the principles that we have in this country, or what our founding fathers found this country on in America, it's not going to survive. And so I want to see more work done, more missionaries, more godly people, godly families going and ministering to the Iraqi people. And it can be done.
Well, now, is the evangelical Christian movement in Kurdistan really growing?
You know, that's a yes and no. I think in America we think about numbers as growth. Excuse me. But that's not necessarily the case in Kurdistan. Anybody can come to the Lord in Kurdistan. I have four things that I ask somebody now, but I didn't ask when I first went to Kurdistan. I asked them four things before if they want to become a Christian. They come to me, "Oh, Mr. Ed, I want to be a Christian." I go, "Okay, let me ask you this. One, you're going to have to repent of your sins and put your faith in Christ Jesus. Two, you're going to have to go tell your family that you're a believer and that you want to follow the Lord. Three, don't expect for me to give you a visa. So a lot of them want a visa, so they want to be a Christian to get you get out of the country. And four, you're going to have to study with me for long periods of time in discipleship, and fruit will come from that. But those are basically the four premises, Dr. Stan, that I start to share with people over time. Many of them will say, no, I don't want to be a Christian now. The reason is because when you sit with somebody that's not a Christian and you start to disciple them because they say they want to be, and they say that Jesus prayer, sinner's prayer, you find out 6 months, 8 months later that they have just deceived you. And up to a certain point, then they'll pop a question and say, Mr. Ed, I need a favor. Yes? Well, I'd like to, can you help me do this or do that or do this? And you say, no, I have no means of doing that. They'll never show up for discipleship again.
All right, so this is sort of a standard technique. Something within this society say it's perfectly all right to lie or deceive or things like that?
Yes, that's true. That's Quranic, and I think that that's a very common thing for almost all Muslims to do. Lying and deceiving and unforgiveness is a common trait. It's if you can deceive people masterfully, then you've done a good job. That's something that we have to work with and against all the time when we're as people of God trying to work in that region. Now let me just say, when I talk about the Kurdish church, the Lord is doing a work there. There are Christians that are there that are Kurds. There are believers that are coming to the Lord and being discipled. I know of them that are Kurds. I know that they're serving the Lord, and they're putting all their energy and their heart into seeing the kingdom of God being advanced in that area. This is happening. It's happening in Iran. It's happening in Iraq. We don't hear it on the news. We don't hardly hear it in Christian news, but it does exist. I've seen it with my own eyes.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, the thing is that is it happening on a large scale? Is it very unusual? And if you are suddenly a Muslim and you convert to Christianity, and we know that in many Muslim societies, they will simply kill you or banish you. It's not quite like that in Kurdistan, is it? It's not quite the stigma of being a Christian that would be in other Muslim communities?
Well, there's different levels of stigma. Right. In Kurdistan, primarily, you're not going to get killed if you confess Christianity. You can get killed. Your life can be threatened, but most likely not. But there is a stigma. There is a cost to be paid for being a Christian. I think it's very biblical. Here, we don't have much of a cost to be paid. But there, it is. Shame, dishonor to the family, a verbal persecution, threats of being cut off from the family, pressure. Everything revolves around the family in Iraq. The father is the patriarch. He is the one who controls the family. So when you're against the father, you have a problem. And this does happen. We have, right now as I speak, there's a woman who is going through this. She became a believer, and she is feeling the pressure from her family now. So pray for her when the Lord reminds you to do so.
All right, fine. And then, of course, now what about the schools? I understand that you set up various schools over there, Christian schools that the Muslims send their children to. Why would Muslims want to send their children to a Christian school?
Well, it's quite interesting. When you look at the news in Baghdad, you think, how can you do anything? How can you set up anything over there? Because you have the Shia and the Sunni killing one another, and how can you be Christians in the middle? But this is not the case in Kurdistan, which is the northern part of Iraq. We have been invited by the government to do so, and we have had permission to build, given land and permission to build schools, which we have. Which we have built them. There are over 800 children in our schools, and they're learning English curriculum from a Christian perspective. And they are starting to see change in their lives and in their hearts. Now keep in mind, to teach a child who comes from a Muslim background not to litter is a very difficult task, because littering is very common. It took me 2 years to start really getting through the mind of the children that littering is not a good thing. And we started to see fruit in that. Excuse me. We started to see fruit in that, where kids started to throw their trash away. Because, why? They saw a Christian worldview. In the Quran, Allah is not immanent with his creation. He is transcendent, totally other. Allah is a sheer will, not a person, and not a trinity. Therefore, reverence and obedience to Allah is out of sheer fear, not out of love or devotion, as we know it in Christianity. So God, or Allah, is not concerned primarily with the earth, like we are as Christians. So to teach a Muslim child that God is immanent, God is with his people, God cares about the earth, this is why you shouldn't litter. It takes time to change. And people might say, oh, but that's silly. It's not silly. When I'm in Iraq, 8 months out of the year, I have to take my asthma inhaler twice a day. I can't breathe. They pour the oil in the streets. They wash their cars in kerosene. They push their cars into the lakes and wash their cars, and all the oil goes down in there. The pollution is crazy. And in the States, I've been back. I haven't used my inhaler one time.
All right, fine. So it's really just an entirely different world over there. And of course, Ed has been there for a number of years, and he's back here temporarily. He's going to be staying here for the time being. And do you want to talk at all about what you're going to be doing here? I understand you're going to be working there in Tennessee. Because there's a real problem in the United States, you know, in areas where there are a lot of Kurds. Because the second generation, these young people, Americanized, they're getting into Kurdish gangs, and these are rather violent gangs, and creating real problems in Tennessee. Why don't you just cover that aspect of what you're going to be doing?
Sure. Well, my family and I lived in Iraq for quite a while, so now we're going to be staying stateside. Some of the problems that the Nashville police are having with Kurds is that the second generation...
Now you're talking about here in the United States.
United States. You know, the first generation really came here in 1991-92, after the first Gulf War. And 7,000 Kurds were transported by plane, and a lot of the Nashville families opened up their, Christian families opened up their homes and bought extra couches and got places for these Kurds to live. And these older Kurds that came had younger Kurds, you know, 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old, so and so on. Now that it's been 12, 13 years, these kids have grown up or are starting to grow up more and more, and they're losing some of who they are. Now, to go into this is very extensive, but they're trying to find out who they are. Who are we? Are we Muslims? We live in a Christian land. Who are we? We speak some of the language, but we don't know our culture like our parents do, so forth and so on. And whatever excuse you want to use, they're forming these gangs, and the police are trying to figure out why. Why are these problems? Why do these problems exist?
Are these violent gangs? Are these gangs into crime and drugs and all that things that gangs are elsewhere?
They're starting to become that way. They're not like the Crips or the Bloods in L.A., but they're starting to become more, you know, little crime here, little crime there, but it's starting to get bigger. So what I want to do, along with my coworker, is to really try to work alongside the police in Nashville to reach this lost generation, so to speak. One way that you do it is, since we've lived in Iraq, we have a little bit of understanding of what the way the Middle Eastern mind thinks. And I was listening, I can't remember who I was talking to today, but they were listening to a radio program that had an interview with the Iranian president recently.
Ahmadinejad?
Right. And they were noticing that the American journalist was asking these questions to the Iranian president, and there was just a total different understanding of East and West. So we need to help the Nashville police understand the difference between Eastern thinking and Western thinking.
Yeah, that was probably the interview that was shown last night on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. And
yes, that was
Ahmadinejad. And Mike had asked one question, and Ahmadinejad had answered a different question.
That's exactly right.
And is that really the way it is when you're getting...
Well, he's not asking the right questions.
All right, fine. Well, when we get back, if you'd like to talk to Ed, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Ed Nippers with us this evening. It's good to see him back here after... Oh, it's been a couple of years since he's been up here. Well, Ed, certainly there's a problem there that you're going to be working with the gangs there in Nashville. What about the indigenous Muslim population? Are you going to be working with them as well?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. That's very true. I'm going to be trying to establish, first of all, a Kurdish church by God's grace. It's very difficult to do. Just to get two Kurds together that are believers is tough. And my friend, my co-worker, has been trying to do that for a couple of years. And finally, by God's grace and mercy, has had some success in that area. But I would love to go into mosques and sit and listen to the mullahs and talk to people that are there. That's going to be part of my job. Do pray for me in that. That's going to be a tough thing to do. But also, there's also a women's center in Nashville that my coworker has put up, and I'm going to be helping her do some work in her women's center, and going two or three times a year over to Iraq to bring in some pastors and some worship team leaders, and to encourage the indigenous believers as well as the other Christians that are there that need, you know, as Christians in the Middle East. You don't get a lot of people coming over to minister to you. Not like if you were in Hawaii or you were, you know, some other island where you could just have conferences all day long and turn on Christian radio and go to the Christian bookstore and buy a Christian book. You can't do that there. So when someone comes that can play guitar or as a pastor can minister to your needs, help you, it's like really fresh, cold water in a dry, hot, dusty desert. It really feels good. It fills your soul. And I have a heart to reach my Christian brothers that they can be filled up and continue the work there, because I know exactly how they feel.
All right, fine. And so you'll be then going back and forth over there. What about the Christian schools? Would you be working with them as well?
On some level. They need some spiritual counseling. The children need spiritual. The missionaries that are there need some understanding more and more. I'm the senior Christian fellow there out of our team, and so I have the most experience, and I say that with most experience with little knowledge, because it's very hard to understand the Middle East, Jermaine. We were talking about the Iranian president and the 60 Minutes interview. You know, the way that you discuss issues with a Middle Eastern person is not direct like we do. Did you do this? Okay. Or accusatory. When you start accusing Middle Eastern people, you've lost them. Totally. There's a way to communicate with a Middle Eastern mind. And one way you do it is you do it through stories. They understand stories. A story is like David and Nathan in the Bible. A story is somewhat neutral, but yet it makes the point very loud and clear to the Middle Eastern mind. David understood what the prophet was saying to him when he sinned with Bathsheba. Now, he didn't come up to him and say, "Now, David, you sinned with Bathsheba, and you did this, and you did that." That would have been bad. But he told a story. And then he brought out the facts. That's how you kind of talk with a Middle Eastern person as you're trying to minister to them.
It's so foreign to our way of thinking, but then I guess it takes you a long time to really begin to understand an entirely different culture.
I'll give you an example. There's and you're probably very familiar with it, Dr. Stenders.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Ed Nippert. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ed is just talking about how you communicate with people from the Middle East, pointing out that you never do anything confrontational, and you never might even ask them a direct question. What you would do would be to tell them a story. And that story would have a message in it, and then they would begin to understand what you were saying through the message, rather than, of course, when of course, you have Mike Wallace asking President Ahmadinejad, you know, did you really say that you want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth? And Ahmadinejad's talking about entirely different things, because he doesn't want to address that issue. Well, and there'd be other ways to accomplish this. But you would have to understand how Ahmadinejad thinks. He thinks differently than we do. This is the problem. We have our diplomats going over there, negotiating with people, and we're talking about apples, and they're talking about oranges, and we don't understand why they don't want our apples.
Now, yeah, it's interesting. They're not dumb. They know what you're asking and they know why you're asking it. So they understand this. For example, when I had a Christian brother, a Kurd, there's some things that happened in Kurdistan against me. The church left. The church was meeting in my house, and it left my house because I caught them trying to do some bad things that wasn't healthy, and I pointed it out to them, and they didn't like I pointed it out to them, so they decided to leave my house pretty much unannounced and not continue church. Well, 3 months go by, and they boycott me and so forth and all this. 3 months go by, one of the elders of the church comes up to me, and he starts to tell me a story. And he's telling me, you know, this is what he says. I have this friend, and I think I hurt his feelings, and I'm not quite sure, and there was something that happened, and he starts, and I have no idea at this point he's talking about me. I have no idea. And this is 3 months after the fact. And then he says, I want to ask for forgiveness, but what do I do? I said, well, just go up and talk to him. Just go up and say, hey, you know, I did this to you. And that's what I said. So he finally became Western, and he said, well, it was you, Mr. Ed, and what happened with the church, and when we left your house, I just want to ask, I'm sorry. And I said, oh, please. That was so 3 months ago, I don't even remember the incident. And I didn't. But he had to tell me a story in order, but I didn't get it. So then he had to be more direct. And that happens all the time in the Middle East. All the time.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, I think that perhaps we might even... Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you'd like. You know, to give us a call. You have a question for Ed here. But right now, you know, we hear a lot about, Chris, increasing tension over there. Talk about a war with Iran. What is your view on that? Because it's totally illogical that we would go to war with Iran, but... Is there a concern about that among the people in your part of the of Iraq? And what about the other parts of Iraq?
I think some of the Kurds talk about that. I'm not quite sure if they're concerned about it. They may be. It's really hard to get a pulse on that. My own personal political opinion is that if America and the coalition forces leave Iraq, say, tomorrow, say someone says, okay, we're leaving. Okay, we'll leave tomorrow. I wouldn't have any doubt in my mind that Iran would swoop down from the east into the south and love to take over Iraq. I wouldn't have any doubt that that would happen. And I fear that it's kind of like you get blamed if you do and you get blamed if you don't. I fear that if that happens... That if America says, oh, well, we're not going to get involved with that, we're not going to do anything, then we're going to get blamed for not doing anything. Most likely, we would go back there with 500,000 American troops. And we would see a great loss, 100, 200, 300, 400 troops a day. Because fighting Iran is different than fighting Iraq. Remember, Saddam fought the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988. Then he went into the Gulf War. At that time, he had an extensive military in 1980. He was building up since 1969, 1979. He was building up his military capabilities. Whatever he had, you know, MiG-17, MiG-21s, jets, 95 of them. He had, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of 6,250 tanks, you know, all this stuff. Well, a lot of that got lost in the Iranian war. So when we went in 91, you know, it wasn't much to conquer. But Iran is not that way. They are fully different than Iraq and prepared to fight. So you have to be careful here.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, what you're saying is we got into a war with Iran. It could be much more difficult.
I believe that. What do you think, Dr. Stan?
And, Chris, but, you know, what's happening in the South? Do you think they're ever going to be able to have peace between the Sunnis and the Shias, or would they be better off simply to split that up into two separate countries and actually have three separate countries, one for the Kurds, one for the Shias, one for the Sunnis, and let them determine their own destiny rather than us try to force them to live as we want them to? And hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I was just asking Ed what his thoughts were as far as the future of the southern part of the country. Is there any way that the Sunnis and the Shias are going to be able to live together in peace, having hated one another for centuries, or would it be better to allow them to separate and have a Shia part of the country, a Sunni part of the country, Kurdish part of the country, and let the people determine their own future rather than us forcing them to live as we want them to?
Well, I think in an ideal world, we would all want everyone to get along, obviously. But looking at the history, the recent history of Iraq, when you have taken through 1940s, 50s, on through Saddam, some of the things that Saddam did well, he was evil. And he played the military against the Ba'ath Party. Or he played the Ba'ath Party when he felt too many people were getting power. He played the Ba'ath Party against the military. Or if he felt that the Ba'ath Party was getting too powerful, he played the people in the military against the Ba'ath Party. So he had a nice little triangle going on. And keeping that balanced, he did very, very well. And he used a lot of money doing it, okay? A lot of money. So the people have learned in the last 30 years not to trust. Factor number one. Not to trust. Who do I trust? Who can I tell my secrets to? Who can I tell my most intimate thoughts, what I'm thinking about? That's number one. Two is you have great religious political parties there. Dr. Stan, in America, you know this. There's a tendency to separate religion and politics, or religion and life, or what have you. But not in Iraq. The Shia are not going to separate their religion and their politics. The Sunna are not going to separate their religion and their politics. It goes hand in hand, glove with hand. And this is a problem. So you have two different, and you have other groups involved too, okay? You have other Islamic groups that are involved. So you have these groups of people who want power. As the Kurds say, we have many Saddams running around the country. They want power, they want position, they want recognition, and they're going to fight for it. Now remember, most of Iraq is Shia, most of Iran is Shia, though most of Islam is Sunni. So you have 60% of Iraqi people are Shia, and a lot of them are in Baghdad. And Saddam was Sunni. And so Saddam feared the Shia because of the Ayatollah Khomeini and what went on there. He feared the Shia rising up in power, and so for 30 years he squashed them. He put them down.
Hold on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was first of all, before we go on, our guest is Ed Nipper, and he's been a missionary to Kurdistan for some years. Ed, would you like to get your address out, your telephone number, how people get in touch with your ministry if they'd like to?
Sure. My email address is iraqifam@yahoo.com.
Iraqifam, that's F-A-M?
That's right, iraqifam@yahoo.com. And shoot me off an email, and I'll be happy to answer you.
All right, we've supported Ed in the past. We think the work he does is outstanding. We can't... Barbara and I get a little old for going off in the missionary field, but certainly we can help others. And we've known Ed for many, many years, and he's totally dedicated to what he's doing. But anyway, I'd asked Ed, what the chances were that we could just get, the Sunnis and the Shias and the Kurds all to live together in one big, happy, democratic society. And Ed was just saying, well, in an ideal world, that'd be fine, but the reality is that, you've had the Shias who can't separate their political and religious conviction, and you have the Sunnis who can't separate their religious and political position. I assume that's pretty well true with the Kurds as well. So is there any way we can force them to live together? Do you think we might do better simply to, let them go ahead and just form their own countries and try to live happily that way, rather than try to force them to give into our position and live together when they hate one another?
Well, I think that's a very tough question. I was talking to one particular person, and they were advocating more negotiations, more talk. I know the government wants to take a break, and many people are saying in America, you know, why are they taking a break when they have a very loose government to begin with? And a break is very important to the Iraqi people. That's when they rejuvenate themselves. That's when they're being able to really bond in relationships. And that's when they're able to negotiate and talk through issues. At least that's what I've observed. Now, to answer your question more directly, there have been times, Dr. Stan, in my own personal life that I said, hey, just leave and let them try to formulate something. That's a possibility. There'll be a lot more deaths, for sure. And I've been tempted to think that way sometimes. On the other hand, I believe that with the right, and this is difficult to do, religiously I can do this, with the right training, democratic principles, which we try to do every day at our schools, with the Bible, I think through long-term we'll see a benefit of that. Because we have a lot of Iraqi leaders' sons in our schools. You know, Dr. Stan, I met with Jalal Talabani's son, Qaban Talabani, in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay, explain to our listeners who Talabani is.
Talabani is the PUK president of Kurdistan. You have Barzani, which is the PDK, and you have the PUK. The PUK is on my side of the country, my side of the state line, and he is, for many, many years, was the prime minister or the president of our side. He is now the president of Iraq. You know, you have the prime minister, the vice prime minister, then you have the president, and so forth and so on.
And he is actually the president of Iraq.
President
of all
of
Iraq. The whole thing, and what they did is brought in a Turk, because the Sunnis didn't want a Shia, and the Shias didn't want a Sunni, so they compromised and brought in Talabani, who's
right.
A Kurd. Go
yeah,
ahead.
He's a Kurd. So his son, who was born in Iraq but educated in London, never lived in Iraq, came to Nashville, Tennessee at Vanderbilt University, and he lectured, and I had a chance to go up and talk to him afterwards. And some of the things that he was saying I agreed on 100%, except there were a few facts that I didn't know. Fact number one, I didn't know that Saddam used chemical weapons 250 times on his people. That was totally new news to me. Second of all, what he was advocating, and pretty strong, was for America to hold position. At least for a while, hold position. Let us help us work through these issues. Americans do have good negotiation skills. We just need to work on a little bit better and do some more tactical things while we're there. So, yeah, I think it's possible, Dr. Stan, that these groups can formulate something, but it's going to be really tough. And someone's going to come out on top, Dr. Stan. Either the Shia is going to come out on top with the dictator, with some mullah, or the Sunnis. It's not going to be like you and I know, you know, a Senate and a Congress, and we're going to vote. It's not going to be like that right now. So that's one part of the puzzle. The other part I want to say, is, and this is not going to be very pleasant, but the people at church, the Assyrians, agreed with me on this. I've always said that if the Turks came into Iraq, not the Americans, let's say the Turks said, well, we're going to help the Iraqis, they would have massacred a lot of people by now. They would have killed tens of thousands of people to get the job done. America went in pretty much with kid gloves on. We're afraid of ABC, we're afraid of NBC, we're afraid of Fox News, and so they're following us day and night, and so it's very difficult to do the job that our soldiers are supposed to do. And I have met special forces. I have met people there who are doing a great job. Our soldiers are doing a good job. They're working hard. They're not loafing around. They're working. They're trying to build. They're risking their lives. And I want to commend them for that, for what they're doing. But I've always said, hey, let's rope off 10 blocks. Put a huge fence around. Get 10, 15, 20 tanks. Send in 20,000 soldiers. And get the insurgents. Everybody knows where the insurgents live. People I talk to in the Middle East agree with me on this. They shake their heads. We know where the bad guys are. We're just not saying anything. Get them. and then execute them. Finish. If you, this is what, and this is funny, I know it's funny, I know it's strange. This is what Saddam did. He made fear come over the people because he had power. There's a time to do that. Now, we almost did something like that, Dr. Stan, when we started to advocate a wall between the Sunni and the Shia areas, if you remember. This is about 2 months ago. But there was a great uproar in the government, don't do this, it's going to be more isolation, more, you know, and so we didn't do it. But sooner or later, mark my words, we're going to have to do something like this if, quote, democracy doesn't kick in. Sooner or later.
But do you think democracy can kick in? Do they have any concept of democracy? And besides that, the Constitution that we install there basically calls for, you know, a socialist state under Sharia law. Everything is according to Sharia law. Why would we create a constitution to put everything under Sharia law? There's no freedom under that. Everything has to be according to the mullahs.
Well, I've seen some of the Constitution. I believe you have too. And I've read certain articles in the Constitution, which I was not very happy with. I'm not very happy with the Constitution. I think it kind of mocks us. And I think there are things in the Constitution that restrict democratic principles. Why this is all done, maybe there's an expert that can answer that question better than I. But as far as reading it, I wasn't very happy with it. In fact, the Arabic reads different than the English, I have been told. I think that, can democracy kick in? Well, from my perspective of working with the church and working with teaching democratic principles such as democracy equals responsibility, that's the basic that we're trying to teach the Kurds.
Yeah, but you're teaching from a Christian perspective.
Yes.
And if you're not dealing with Christians, you're dealing with people from a Muslim perspective.
Yes.
Where democracy has never been accepted, everything has been authoritarian, and coming down, of course, from the mullahs.
Yes, I think, and this is the sticky point. The former is difficult enough; the latter is almost sheer impossible. I don't see, and I'll be honest. I don't see, and maybe there is, but I don't see it. I don't see lectures. Like Kovan Talabani was saying in Nashville, Tennessee, I don't see lectures on and living democratic principles by the West. I don't see people coming in, setting up seminars, doing workshops. I don't see this going on. I do see some military people who are in captains and lieutenants coming to teach law at the law school and our constitution. But I don't see in a majority, if you're going to have a democracy, especially in that culture, Dr. Stan, you need to inundate that culture with democratic principles. I mean, just flood it with day and night. You need to do this. I don't see that going on.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number, if you'd like to talk to Ed, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Ed has certainly been over there living this experience. So if you have a question for him, well, I would love to hear from you. Again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But, I mean, Sydney had been there for a number of years. But were you over there? You were over there before we invaded? You sure?
Yes.
Were there?
Yes, I was there, yes. But I was protected under the no-fly zone.
Okay, fine. Because... have you been down in the southern Iraq at all?
Yes, I've been to Baghdad twice, and the before things got really, really hot, though. Yeah, I've been down there twice.
Now, what about the threat of Turkey invading Kurdistan? Because there's been a lot of, certainly the Kurds are launching attacks into Turkey, and of course the Turks are only going to take that for a certain period of time before they actually attack Kurdistan. Do you foresee this? And if the Turks invade Kurdistan, then what's going to happen?
Right. Well, if they invade Kurdistan, well, first of all, politically, 15 million Kurds live in Turkey, and that's part of Kurdistan. If they invade Iraq, you know, I don't know how the political parties will see this, but I know the Iraqi government is saying to the Turkish government, please, don't do this. I know Turkey has troops on the border. Don't do this. don't come in here and grab the Kurdish rebels or the Kurdish freedom fighters who are trying to secure the rights of their people in eastern Turkey. And by the way, you know, it's against the law for Kurds to speak their language in eastern Turkey, for Kurds to write their language, or for Kurds to name their children after Kurdish names, or even to play Kurdish music. And so, you know, here Turkey wants to get into the EU, and yet it doesn't allow 15 million people the liberty to identify with their own ethnicity. So, in one sense, I understand what Turkey's going through. It wants to take care of the problem that they have. In the other sense, you know, Turkey wants Kirkuk's oil, Dr. Stan. I've been to Kirkuk many, many times. There's lots of oil in Kirkuk, and that's also part of the, quote, Ottoman Empire. No doubt. Wouldn't Turkey want to get a hold of the billions and billions of dollars that exist in the oil? You know, Turkey primarily survives off its, at least in Istanbul, survives off its tourism. Not terrorism, it's tourism. Okay, so, of course they're going to want that money. If they go in, will it be a problem? It might be. Maybe people will turn a blind eye and allow the Turks to do it for a period of time, a week, 2 weeks, whatever. Or maybe it won't. Stay tuned.
So really this whole thing is sort of like a powder keg then?
Yes, I think so. It's a matter of time. But, you know, Turks have been on that border for a long time. And I have driven on those roads, and I have seen some of that military power. The Turkey army is not something you want to fool around with. Of course, they're not as sophisticated and not as powerful as the American army. Okay, granted. But in that region, they are a powerful army. And the Turkish military is not something that you really want to mess with. You should fear them. You know, I personally don't want to see Turkey going in and doing what it could do to Iraq. Because, once a country enters another country, it's going to be there for a while. It's not just going to say, okay, did my job, let's go home. It's going to be there for a while. And Turkey would love to be there, especially in the Kirkuk northern eastern area, for a long time.
Well, of course, we've heard George Bush say that he wants to keep our troops in Iraq for a long period of time. Do you think this is a good idea? And if we keep our troops in Iraq, is there ever going to be any peace in the South?
Well, I don't think at this moment we should just take them out, just like, you know, boom, they're gone tomorrow. I think eventually, and I've said this publicly, that eventually we need to withdraw our troops. When? I don't know. But I do know that, it affords us the opportunity to spy on the land, which I like personally. There's lots of spies, so I like this for us to get as much information as possible. I like that part, believe me, and that's probably going on. I know that there's an American base being built in the Kurdish area, so at least we'll be in the north. This is an interesting statistic, Dr. Stan. There are less than 200 coalition soldiers in the north.
By coalition, you mean, of course, American.
Mostly
and all
American.
Primarily American. The
mostly
coalition
American, right.
Is really American.
Right. Mostly American. And we haven't lost one soldier in the north since the beginning of the war. Not one soldier. Now, 200 soldiers in a 4 million population, and not one soldier lost, compared to 130,000 soldiers in a population of 5 million in one area in Baghdad, you see the difference. You see how the Kurds are managing themselves with 75,000 Peshmergas. That's 75,000 standing army ready to take care of itself, but only with AK-47s, okay? No planes, no tanks, no Humvees, just AK-47s and a few RPGs. That's all they have.
All right, fine, but of course the difficulty is in the south. I mean, we're fighting the Sunnis, we're fighting Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
We got the Sunnis fighting the Shias, and the Shias fighting the Sunnis, and then we've got our own, then you've got the Mahdi's army fighting the other,
right.
Other Shia armies. So you've got about five different wars going on in the south, and our boys are right in the middle of the whole mess.
Yes, that's true. You do have a lot of these factions going on, and a lot of it, you know, if you recall the regime of Saddam and how he played his cards and what he's done to those people, this doesn't surprise me. I don't think it surprises anybody.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment. We've got time for one question. If anybody wants to call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Our guest has been Ed Nipper. Ed, one more time. You want to get your telephone number or your website out?
Yeah. Well, let me give you my email address. It's IraqiFam@yahoo.com. And supporting, you know, I am a missionary, so if you want to support us on a monthly basis, just send me an email, and I'll be happy to send you some information, more information.
And if you need more information, why let us know. We're in constant touch with Ed. Ed Nipper, a missionary, of course, to Kurdistan. I'll be working stateside for a time. Well, Ed, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's program. What are the thoughts you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, three things. One is our listeners need to understand that we are in a spiritual battle, that there are people who love God who are serving in Iraq, who are trying to weigh through the political, the economical, the spiritual battles of the country. And so we desperately covet your prayers. There are people who are putting their life on the line, not only American soldiers, that's what we hear in the news primarily, but tonight, people who love God, who are serving God in these areas. And I know that oftentimes when we look at the Iraqi people or we look at different cultures, including myself, we kind of look down on them or we say certain things about them. But God has created the Iraqi people. He loves the Iraqi people. He loves the Kurds. And He wants to see them come to Him. And I think it's our job to pray for them. It's our job to support those who go to the Middle East. You know, there are more missionaries to the state of Alaska than all of the Middle East combined. Let me say that again. There are more missionaries to the state of Alaska than all missionaries combined to the Middle East. And here we have this huge 1040 window, and it's very hard. Less than one half of 1% of missionary funds are given to Middle Eastern missionaries. So not only are we don't have the funds, we don't have the numbers. For us to get missionaries to go to Iraq to do what I do, we probably get about 2 or 3 a year. That's it. So it's scarce. And people say, oh, but you might die. Yeah, you might die. Well, that's the call of the Christian, is to suffer. You might die. But that's okay. You have a better place to go. Okay.
Well, don't you think one reason why there's so few missionaries is because it's so hard to reach the Muslims because of the barriers, because of the social stigma of conversion to Christianity, because of course you lose your contact with your family.
Yes, it's very hard to reach the Muslims. I mean, St. Francis of Assisi tried to reach the Muslims and didn't have any success, and there are many people who tried to reach the Muslims. Books have been written about this. It is a hard ground. It's hard soil. But remember, Jesus was a Middle Eastern Asiatic. He was a Semite, and he talked to his own people. Do you think reaching the Jews in Israel is an easy job?
No, I'm sure it isn't. Well, our guest this evening has been Ed Nipper. We always enjoy Ed having us coming to stay with us and visiting with us every time he's here. I know you're leaving tomorrow, is it?
Leaving tomorrow morning, finally, to go home to see my wife.
All right, fine. Thanks very much, Ed. God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Ed Nipper, missionary to the Kurdish people, and we've known Ed for a long time, and we're certainly very, very proud of him and what he's taken on. Well, this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners once again that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours a day on one or another medium, primarily 5 hours a day on radio someplace and on internet someplace. They're trying to reach people to understand the true nature of this spiritual battle that is being waged today for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. So if you'd like to help, why give us a call at 1-800-5800-TALK. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you haven't seen my talk on Iraq, The Untold Story, let me recommend it to you. It is available in DVD, it's available in VHS, and it comes with a syllabus. It's a talk we gave several years ago, but, you know, it certainly is going to be updated, but this is certainly as true and accurate when I gave it a couple of years ago as it is today. All of the wars of the 20th century were contrived, every single one of them. We were tricked into going to the Spanish-American War with the sinking of the Maine, but it wasn't the Spain that did it. It was an internal explosion. We were tricked into going to the First World War by faulty propaganda. We were tricked into going to Pearl Harbor because suddenly Franklin Delano Roosevelt did everything he could to encourage the Japanese to attack, and had our troops been on alert at Pearl Harbor, the Japanese wouldn't have attacked. So we left our men there to be killed. The whole story of the Gulf of Tonkin was a lie. We were actually, what happened in Korea was our Secretary of State told the North Koreans that if they attacked South Korea, we would not intervene. The Joint Chiefs of Staff tricked the North Koreans into attacking us, and we were in a war. I mean, the justification for First Gulf War was that Saddam asked the American ambassador, April Glaspie, if we would mind if he took military action against Kuwait. And he was assured that we would not, and suddenly he found himself in a war. And then, of course, we know about the justification for going into Afghanistan was to get Osama bin Laden. The president promised to get him dead or alive, and he just didn't say when we were going to get him dead or alive. The president assures us Osama bin Laden was behind what happened on 9/11, but if you go to the FBI 10 most wanted page and pull down Saddam Hussein, find me a Osama bin Laden. Not one word, not one single word about the attack on the World Trade Center. So I guess the FBI doesn't know that Osama bin Laden was behind what happened. So we want to point out that the reason for all of these wars is there is a desire to bring about a one-world government and a one-world religion, destroy Christianity, and bring about a one-world ruler. And this is a plan that's been around for a long period of time. And we have a great deal of documentation on how we got into this war. It was planned long ahead of time over in Iraq. And until we understand it is part of something much bigger, and that is why I fear we're going to war with Iran here in the very near future. This whole idea is to plunge us into a world war with the Muslim world, and where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims will destroy one another. If you've not yet read my February newsletter, it's available at RadioLiberty.com. We'll be glad to send you a copy. You need to get my talk, Iraq, The Untold Story, and of course get the syllabus along with it. It's available on DVD or VHS. And then of course pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty. And of course remember my talk on Brotherhood of Darkness, the Forbidden Secret, and then the four tape set, The Secret Behind the Secret. So until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be with you again, Dr. Stan. May the Lord be with you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for